Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Lob Podcast from These Football Times. I'm Gareth Thacker, and in this edition, we're going to be talking about a team that has reached the final of a continental tournament against many expectations to the contrary. Assess the job performed by the manager, who has produced a revival in the team's fortunes, and consider how they now sit on the very edge of glory. Well, hang on a bit. No, wait. No. We're not talking about England. In this episode, we'll be trying to South America to consider the revival of Colombia and with their Argentine coach, Nestor Lorenzo. Joining me in this discussion is TFT's very own South American football expert, Dr. Pete Watson. Hi, Pete. The success of Colombia national team and what it means to the country is a subject very close to your heart, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's put up with me on our various podcasts before will know that obviously it's a team very close to my heart. It's the team that I write on, well, the country I write most on when I'm doing my own academic investigations. So, you know, it's anytime there's a Copa America or a World Cup or an Olympics or South American qualifiers, but particularly the major tournaments, it's always a really interesting time to read what kind of messages and meanings and symbolisms are kind of been mentioned and what kind of narratives have been developed around the team and the country. So, yeah, you can imagine that over the last couple of weeks, I've been quite busy following all those things up. And it's been a busy morning after the Uruguay game last night.
I'll bet. Yeah, we'll be touching on that in a minute. Also joining us is another member of the South American Files team, Stevie Scragg. How's it going, Stevie? Colombia's a great subject for talking about football, mate, isn't it?
Absolutely. They definitely need this extra focus as well. You know, Pete will take us through in a lot more detail, but you know, it's remarkable what they've done. You know, not just in this tournament, but you know, to come from kind of like one of those periodical ruts that they have. I mean, don't get me wrong, they've had bigger ruts. But I think in an era in which it's becoming increasingly difficult not to qualify for a World Cup, etc., and to challenge in your own continental tournament, then you know those ruts aren't maybe quite as pronounced as going decades without a World Cup and all that type of thing. But considering where we all thought Colombia were and heading around about a decade ago, they've not fulfilled. But this is them very much striking back.
You've segued nicely into the first topic I wanted to put to you guys. It's been a while since Colombia reached the Copa America final. The last appearance was 2001 and they beat Mexico 1-0. So where's Colombian football been in the intervening years, Pete?
You've got two really defined periods. I guess you've got the period from that particular Copa America through to 2014, where you have, you know, what a lot of Colombians will see as a bit of a black hole. The Colombian golden generation that kind of preceded that 2001 Copa America, you know, the 1990 team, the 1994 team. I mean, arguably not the 1998 team. They were in the World Cup, but that was very much the dying embers of a generation. So after that kind of 2001 triumph, which let's remember was at home, it wasn't a full Copa America. There had been various kidnapping issues. The head of the vice president of the Colombian Football Federation had been kidnapped shortly before the tournament started. It was still at a time of the FARC and the ELN launching various car bomb attacks around major Colombian cities. So several teams didn't go. So in lots of ways, even though it's Colombia's only, well, it's male, their male team's only really major triumph, it's often seen as a little bit of an outlier. You know, not everyone was there. But then there is a bit of a black hole and we don't really have a period of strong teams. They don't qualify for the World Cup until 2014. They're not doing particularly well in the Copa America either. We don't really see any, you know, major global heroes in their football team in that period. You know, you have certain players like, I suppose, Juan Pablo Angel. You have the likes of Hamilton Rickard and Hugo Rodallega. For example, they're players that English fans will know. But we don't have that kind of Valderrama player or that Asprilla player that really sets the pulses racing. So there's a kind of a black hole there. And then we really have a very strong period under Peckerman, José Néstor Peckerman, from 2014, really, well, the qualification, but certainly the World Cup in 2014 and 2018, where a new golden generation emerges that's largely defined by James Rodriguez, but, you know, ably supported by a cast of very, very prominent other stars. You know, in lots of ways, as Stevie said, you know, they should have done really better. Not qualifying for the last World Cup was a bit of a shock. But that kind of brief dip that saw, you know, two real main managerial stints of Queiroz and of Reinaldo Rueda, you know, where there is a dip, has suddenly been kind of replaced. So there's been kind of like a four-year struggle. But I think what we're seeing now is a kind of a coach that's got a very clear idea, a very clear plan. I think we're also seeing in lots of ways a continuation of the Peckerman era. In terms of why, that's difficult to say. I think that, you know, the difficulty of sustaining or producing a new golden generation is difficult. You know, if you get your managerial choices wrong, that creates a problem. But I think that quite often in Colombia, there's often an accusation of improvisation amongst those running the football federations and the talent-seeking programs. So I think that that kind of ability to build on prior knowledge was slightly lost. I think that you also have a problem of having to deal with a lot of your best players suddenly going abroad and ever-increasing age, so they're kind of disconnected from the home area. And that in some ways might not seem as much of a problem if they're getting experience in different countries, but if they're not coming back to be part of a very concrete, organised programme. Let's remember the first golden generation in Colombia is very much a national programme. Most of the players were still playing Colombia. So I think it took time to get to cope with that. I think another issue is just the fact that there are some other very, very good teams in South America going around. We have to look at the growth of the Ecuador team of the early 2000s as being a very strong team. You've obviously got the likes of Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, they're always there. So it's not an easy environment to play well in, if you don't have that influential player and the correct manager that can really create something. I think they tried to go backwards a lot. They tried to go back to the likes of Hernan Dario Gomez and Francisco Maturana for management, but arguably that particular time had gone, that particular style of play had probably gone, that kind of golden moment had gone. So I think there's all kinds of reasons why that black hole between kind of 2001 and 2014 really existed.
Yeah, it's fascinating, Stevie. And it's, I mean, in the pods we've done on South America files in the past, Pete's mentioned about the hierarchy and the fact that, you know, they've got Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Colombia always seems to be sort of bumping up against that ceiling occasionally, but never seem to get to break through. I mean, they're not the classic up and down team, aren't they? You know, they have sort of periods of success, as you mentioned, and then in sort of these dips, as Pete just described.
Yeah, and even in contemporary terms, Uruguay, you know, have only recently-ish come back to play the third wheel in that hegemony. You know, they had their own, you know, drift over periods of time. So, you know, you'd have Argentina, you'd have Brazil, and then another. You know, I look back to the 1982 World Cup, and it's Chile and it's Peru. You know, 86, you have the coming of Paraguay. You know, so Uruguay even weren't within that. You know, they were kind of like this archaic name from the past that were winning World Cups when the television cameras weren't around. You know, it's only, you know, as your knowledge of these nations expands, and you know, you grow up a little bit and you read into it and all that type of thing, you come to appreciate football of a black and white era and the standing of such teams in the global order. But yes, you know, Uruguay have very much gone on to become or to re-establish themselves as being part of that triumvirate now of domination in South American football, national football. But yeah, that third or fourth wheel, if you wish, you know, Colombia of, you know, we've mentioned it before in that concept of playing it like a relay, you know, whether that's 3, 4, 5 year cycles, suddenly here comes Colombia as they were in 94 and 98. And, you know, then they kind of like drop the ball and Paraguay come back in 2002, reaching a World Cup quarterfinals. And, you know, you have that cycle, even Ecuador have thrown the hat into the ring. Peru have come back, you know, to an extent. So Colombia's, these ebbs and flows are just, you know, part and parcel of what is a changing landscape. It'll be very, very different as we look towards the 2026 World Cup and the expansion of qualification, which might get very, you know, very, very hard for certain nations not to qualify for a World Cup. But Colombia, quite, I don't know, unique in that way is that, you know, I think we were all impressed a decade ago. You know, 2014 World Cup, they reached the quarterfinals. know, Peckerman's Columbia played some magnificent football, and then not to kind of grow on that. Yeah, they reached the semi-finals of the Copa America 2016, but there's a pronounced drift after that, really. Yes, they come third in 2021, but it's a ghost tournament, you know, in empty stadiums, you know, so it's hard to kind of place that within the wider lexicon of Copa Americas and South American football of that time. But, you know, it's not that they're without talented players. They've got some outrageously gifted players, but maybe there's an added pragmatism to them at the minute, which, you know, is kind of refreshing to see, because they can still turn it on. But yeah, the last 10 years, yeah, it is that, I don't know, that cycle that's so fascinating. And Colombia play that role just as much as Chile do. You know, Chile, we're looking at them being Copa America winners back-to-back not all that long ago, and then suddenly they're out of the picture again. And, you know, at the minute, it's kind of like Colombia coming round that wheel towards the top end of it, while your Chiles and your Paraguays and your Perus are working the way, maybe on the downward or lower upward cycle of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just to sort of complete the sort of setting of the scene, as we should say, before we move on to what's happening now. You both mentioned, so you for a second, Stevie, you both mentioned about groups of players that come through, and they seem to have these like a burst of three or four players to come through together. And although they perhaps don't have massive success, and it drifts away, and it just seems like, you know, it's difficult to identify the reason why you get that burst and then that sort of lull again.
Yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to it sometimes. I mean, merit. International football, we often mention about it being, you know, it's a biological edge to it rather than a checkbook edge to it. Yes, certain FAs are more bankrolled than others, but you're still heavily reliant upon the quality of a generation of players that have to come from that nation. You know, yeah, you can get your ringers in and stuff like that, where it's kind of like, you know, second generation and what have you. Not looking at you, Ireland, there. I'm not looking at all. But, you know, within that, you know, that's just, it's part of the beauty of it, because you can't buy your way out of trouble. You can't buy your way out of a rut or stagnation or whatever it is. You know, you do have to rely upon, you know, the basic genetics of the parents who are creating the players, basically. And, you know, that's why, you know, you do get that flux in international football, is that whoever is on top and on top of the game and bouncing along, they will soon be knocked off. You know, they really, really will. And, you know, you're looking at Argentina now. You know, they might well break Colombian hearts in the early hours of Monday, you know, morning. But, you know, there would be a team winning three major international tournaments on the spin. You know, a remarkable achievement for a team that I think prior to that Copa America in 2021, we'll be going back to 1993 since they'd last won a major international tournament. Argentina win that World Cup in Qatar in 2022. First time since, 2002 that a World Cup had been won by a South American team. The first time that a World Cup had been won not by a European nation. So, you know, that's the beauty of international football. It's just a shame that FIFA and its, you know, component parts are constantly trying the best to make it, you know, to break international football in a way.
It's interesting you mentioned about you can't buy checkbook players and South America Files episode we'll be doing not too far down the road might sort of go against that, certainly a few years ago. But Pete, just come to you briefly about the same sort of thing. I mean, these burst of players, is there any sort of logical reason to it? Is it like the injection of capital or something?
Obviously, the first Colombian golden generation, there are certain capital issues that are famously involved or infamously involved. There is certainly the whole narco football years that is so unfortunately indelibly associated with that success. You know, there is a drop off without doubt in the financing of Colombian football in the intervening years. You know, sometimes I wonder whether, you know, the kind of country insecurity, you know, in that kind of the late 1990s and the early 2000s in some way prohibits the scouting of talent or the locating of players, or the nature of conflict is maybe meaning that instead of, you know, playing football and in kind of the streets and the roads, you know, there's a kind of a, you know, joining of gangs or even joining of militias or joining of paramilitaries or the guerrillas. I mean, I kind of wonder, I mean, it's such an intangible idea, but you kind of wonder, you know, that so many children are impacted so badly by the war. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what impact that really has. You know, are the scouts going to Colombia to look for players in the Colombian league at that time? You know, are the foundations of Colombian football so badly eroded and badly shook up that, the kind of way in which they're looking to develop is not there? You know, in lots of ways as well, you know, I mean, Stevie mentioned that the hierarchy question has always been an aspect of what we've talked about with Colombian football. And, you know, I guess that just below that era of the Colombian generation, that kind of, you know, the late teens are not used to Colombia winning. And maybe it takes another 10 years for the kids that are, you know, 6, 7, 8 at the time of, you know, Valderrama, Asprilla, Fred Rincon to kind of be thinking, actually, we can beat Argentina, we can beat Brazil, we can beat, you know, these European teams. And maybe it takes them 10 years to come through. There are lots of imponderables. And again, a lot of Colombia's own systems are questionable. I think what you can also see is you can also look at the Copa Libertadores as an indicator of what Colombian clubs are achieving. So I think that, you know, you have to have that starting point somewhere, you know, and I think that confidence in club football can often translate into the international team. And the 2000s are a little bit of a blank period for Colombia as well. I mean, you have Once Caldas winning in, I think, 2004 or 2006. But that wasn't a very Colombian team. That's a highly defensive team that wins on the strength of solidity and a very good coach, in fact. So I think there's lots of factors that come together. I do think that one of the major problems that any Latin American team is that because their component parts are so disparate. You know, once the seeds of promise emerge, they're quickly sown to the winds of all these different corners of Europe and even probably different countries now, whether we can add the Middle East and North America. You know, their players are kind of so spread out that it's even harder to get them together. You know, those connections are kind of lost. So I wonder whether just that process of bringing together the talent every time there is a game, you know, is a very difficult process. You know, I wonder if that also is somehow part of the issue. And again, you know, we're looking at a federation or a group of teams in South America. There's only nine of them, I think. That's always hard. You just have to lose a couple of games and you're gone in a Copa America. You just have to play Brazil in an early round and you're gone. It's a very tricky art to get success, particularly as quite often the groups are loaded. You know, you're never going to see Brazil and Argentina in the top group. If you happen to be a decent Ecuadorian team or a decent Colombian team or a decent Peruvian team at that time, you know, and you just get the wrong group, you're waiting for another 4 years now. It's not like it used to be where they were playing every year back in, you know, the 1920s.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, okay, so there's a seed setting. So 2 years ago, after Colombia failed to qualify for the World Cup, manager was sacked and they appointed Néstor Lorenzo. I mean, the question will be to many people listening to this perhaps is, who the hell is Néstor Lorenzo? Unless you live in the heart of Wiltshire, which you might sort of say, well, actually, yeah, we know he is. So give us a little bit about Néstor Lorenzo, buddy.
I mean, he's known in England, I guess, for Swindon Town. And there's some stories which I've been kind of reading up on this morning. But I mean, really, you know, football cognoscenti, if you like, might remember him from 1990. You know, he was a member of the Argentina World Cup squad in 1990. He actually plays in only two games. He plays in a loss against Cameroon and he plays in a loss in the final. So it's not an ideal World Cup for Néstor. You know, he'd also played in the 1988 Olympics before that. It was a kind of a rugged centre-back. Had been brought up at Argentinos Juniors. You know, obviously that's the club of Diego Maradona. But he could play. You know, he went to Bari after his early successes, and that was a bit of a potential route into major success. But then it didn't really happen. The Swindon story is fascinating. He only is signed because that's the time when Osvaldo Ardiles is manager. They've just been relegated to the second tier of English football. And, you know, you can imagine that Lorenzo is very excited to play with a legend of the country, you know, and also, you know, to maybe make a new start. Hadn't gone particularly well in Bari. It's a loan signing originally. And, you know, I was reading up on it this morning. The first game that he played in was against Portsmouth. Did the noble thing and beat them 3-0, scored a goal, you know, immediately winning his, you know, lots of fans on the South Coast. But he's playing in a back four with Paul Bowden, obviously a good player for Wales. And then AD Vivash, I don't know how to pronounce that surname, Vivash, and Tom Jones. So, you know, probably wasn't unusual for him to be doing well in such a back four. But then, you know, the problem that he has is that Ardiles leaves and joins Newcastle. The only reason for him to be there is gone. He doesn't get on with Glenn Hoddle, apparently. He's quite candid about it, although apparently he did meet him in the future and had a big hug. But the other reason that apparently he wasn't playing much is that Swindon are in financial troubles at the time. You know, he's on a slightly, you know, the transfer fee has some kind of pay-to-play clause, apparently. So he doesn't really play a great deal under Hoddle. Hoddle is playing at centre-back. You've got Colin Calderwood, I think he's still there. So you've got a World Cup finalist who is barely playing any football. He then returns to Argentina, has a good career for clubs like San Lorenzo, ends up at Boca Juniors as well, which is a childhood club. But I think what's interesting really is the managerial career. And I think that, you know, many people say he doesn't have one. He has a great assistant manager career. In lots of ways, you know, he is the number two to José Néstor Peckerman, probably or arguably one of Colombia's greatest managers. Along with Maturana, Lorenzo arguably is putting himself in that category now. But he's the number two, and he's there when he's in there for the Argentina under-20. He's there for the Argentina national team. He's there in a couple of quite unsuccessful spells in Mexico, but also he's there in Colombia. So a lot of its success is being part of the Peckerman unit. His only managerial career before taking on the Colombia job is at Melgar. Again, not one of the great South American teams. We're looking at a kind of a Peru. Where we put Melgar, certainly not in the top three of Alianza Lima Universitario Sporting Cristal. They're one of the also rans from Arequipa. And after a not particularly strong start, he then leads them to the Apertura title in 2022. And it's probably that brings him back to the Colombia position. So this isn't someone who's got tons of titles. This isn't someone who's got lots of managerial appointments. He's got obviously, you know, a career as a top-level footballer, although quite a short one in lots of ways. You know, doesn't have that kind of that European experience that many of the top Argentinian managers have had. Think of Pochettino, for example. So he's kind of come in a lot of ways out of the shadows, you know, off the bench to suddenly be in the limelight in this tournament more than ever before. And again, it's worth you know, noting that Colombia currently has an unbeaten record of 28 games on the spin. Now, not all of those run under Lorenzo. I think four games run under, I think briefly, Hector Cárdenas and the dying embers of Reinaldo Rueda, under whom they couldn't score to save themselves, but didn't concede many either. But that's a remarkable record, bearing in mind that I think the world record for most, you know, the longest run of unbeaten games is something like 35 or 36. You know, and they've played Brazil, they've beaten Brazil, they've drawn against Brazil, they've beaten Uruguay and drawn against them, they've beaten Spain, they've beaten Germany. You know, they haven't beaten Argentina. That was the last team that beat them. But they're not playing Venezuela every week. And again, Venezuela are, you know, not a bad team either at the moment. So, you know, it's an impressive run. You know, and he's really kind of, you know, setting, getting people talking about how good is he, particularly after he's just, you know, the Colombia team have just beaten the famed Marcelo Bielsa, you know, with 10 men for over 45 minutes. And Bielsa's Uruguay, arguably man for man, given where they're playing, given where most of his players are playing, should be winning that game.
Yeah, it's interesting, fascinating. I mean, the game yesterday was, what's the word we've got? A part temperamental, a part tumultuous. It's interesting you mentioned, I didn't realise that AD Vivash had played alongside him. And it's interesting, Swindon back four then, that Vivash went on to, a former Warsaw player, where I come from, also went on to be a big wheel in the Chelsea Academy that produced all those Youth Cup winning teams. So, yeah, perhaps playing the Swindon back four is a good idea for, you know, aspiring coaches. Stevie, it's interesting when you get them, you know, a sort of unsung hero taking over national team. And you know, fascinating that he served under Peckerman as well. Do you think that was a great advantage to him to have that sort of schooling with a successful, you know, Colombian coach before?
Absolutely. I mean, just going back to his Swindon days for a split second, he actually joined them when they were meant to be going into the first division. At the end of the 89-90 season, they'd won promotion via the playoffs, but it was all imploding behind the scenes because of financial irregularities and, you know, betting scandals and all that type of thing. So his initial kind of like, come, you know, from our dealers is, come and join me, come and join my team that's just made it into the first division. Only in a court of law to be actually sent down to the third division to win on appeal promotion back to the second division about 10 days later, which actually kind of messed Tranmere Rovers around a lot, I seem to remember, because they were handed basically Swindon's place in the second division for about 10 days before going back down to the third. And Sunderland ended up being promoted to the first division on the back of finishing about sixth in the second division and losing the playoff final. It was just an utterly ludicrous turn of events. But this is the landscape in which he arrived at Swindon, and also having just had a season at Barry. And this is a Barry side that are kind of, I don't know, what do you want to compare them to at this point in time? Maybe kind of like an English version of, I don't know, maybe a Charlton Athletic or something like that at that point in time. So to finish ninth in Serie A, it isn't a bad thing. And he'd also, this is an era in which you can only sign three foreign players in Serie A. So you've got Serie A clubs having to be particularly choosy over which imports they bring in. It's not the trawler net that goes through the waters of nowadays. You literally can only field three, non-Italians. So, they've sourced him and been considered about it. So, as a player, he certainly had, he might not have been one of the best defenders in the world, one of the best, most cultured players in the world, but he was clearly doing something right. And to end up in that Argentina squad for the 1990 World Cup and to be a starter in that Cameroon game and clearly be one of the scapegoats on the defeat against Cameroon. But then to come back into the final after all of those suspensions that Argentina clocked up. As they approached the final, so there was something about him as a player, but as a coach, I think you're clearly looking at someone who is adaptable, someone who is something of a sponge for information. He's taking on the learnings of Peckerman. It's impressive. To get certain coaches who serve under what are seen as visionary coaches or expansive coaches, it's not always easy for those perceived underlings to spread the wings elsewhere and to achieve. We can even if we're looking at Mikel Arteta, having served under Pep Guardiola, he's still being denied that Premier League title. There's an FA Cup to his name, but he's still just slightly out of reach of those very biggest prizes. So, it isn't always easy to step out of that shadow. But for him to do what he's doing at the minute, to guide Colombia through to the Copa America final and to have them sat very healthily in World Cup qualifying terms as well, I think we can switch the lights out on the fact that, unless they really hit the self-destruct button, they're going to be involved in the 2026 World Cup without a shadow of a doubt. So, and then looking at the football that his teams play as well, there was a pragmatic edge to the game against Uruguay, which kind of ties into that concept of the hierarchy. Suddenly, here we are playing someone that is supposedly ahead of us in the food chain, as such, the CONMEBOL food chain, a deference at play and let's be a little bit more circumspect. But it's succeeded. They've gone out there and got the win, which will just kind of add to the confidence, a growing confidence. And Lorenzo needs a lot of credit for this. There's no doubt about it. You can have all the talented players in the world, but to make them play together and to have that, there is an eye of the storm come, timing is everything, and here they are. So he's clearly taken a lot on from Peckerman. He's learned a lot, and he's put his own hat on it.
Yeah, it's interesting, I guess. When a new coach comes to a club, almost inevitably it's because the previous guy's failed. The only way is up, as it were. And yet, also you've got a problem where players will be lacking confidence. And there are some star players there. James Rodriguez was there, and yet he has to pick these guys up, Stevie. And I guess perhaps with that experience playing with Peckerman, and perhaps having the success with the club team before he moved there, confidence wasn't short in him, perhaps, and belief that he could do the job.
Yeah, and I think familiarity from the player's perspective has to play a big part in this. But like I say, that's what makes international football fascinating, because like I said earlier on, you don't have that check, but you can't just say, all right, well, this player's not working out, let's go and sign a new one. You have to look at what's coming up. You have to look at what you've already discarded, and can they come back into the picture? you know, a very different way of succeeding, a different way of team building and putting these teams together compared to club football. So, you know, there's a lot about the chemistry of teams, and you know, it's the players and it's the coaching staff, and everything's got to be harmonious, and that's really difficult to do in international football, because you're bringing in these players from, you know, different schisms of club origins, and you know, and within that you just have to look down the list of the squad that Colombia have taken there, and just where they're playing the football across, you know, it's they're globally scattered. This is very different to, you know, the squads that Colombia are putting together in 1990, you know, where very few of the players are playing the football outside of Colombia. So, you know, it's a plate spinning act. And in a way, you know, there is always kind of a balance between, you know, the coaches and his players, you know, over, you know, they work in unison. You know, you can't just give all the credit to one and not the other. You know, the players cannot perform the way that they're doing in this tournament without, you know, the influence of the coach and the vision of the coach, because they set the tone, they set the, you know, they set the parameters. This is what I want my team to do, and, you know, bring the players in to play those key component parts. So, but the players have got to buy into that, and they've got to feel like the part of it. And, you know, clearly that is what's happening for Colombia at the minute. I mean, how long that can last, because like I said earlier on, that cycle, you know, will not stop. It will go round, and Colombia, you know, the stabilizers will fall off at some point, and they'll wobble to the side of the road, and it'll be and it'll be Chile who have got the momentum, you know, which is, but you know, at the minute everything's fantastic, and I think no matter what happens on Monday, early hours of Monday morning, you've got a great story there, because either you've got this amazing turnaround of Colombia from not qualifying for the 2022 World Cup to being Copa America winners, or you've got Argentina doing something absolutely exceptional and winning three back-to-back major international tournaments that they've been involved in.
Yeah, good point. I guess, you know, here's a million-dollar question, Pete. Bear in mind that, you know, when he took over, he got players like Rodriguez, who's sort of, and others whose career sort of almost got into terminal drift away from, you know, top clubs in playing in Saudi League and such like. How do you do it? How did Nestor Lorenzo pick these players up, inspire them and get them to play the football they want to, the successful football?
I mean, that is the million-dollar question. And I think there are various kind of key things. I think, firstly, there is a knowledge of what he's got. You know, I think that something that Colombia always did was not just have friendlies for the foreign teams, you know, the players that were based aboard, the kind of the first teamers. So when Peckerman is putting together his 2014 and 2018 squads, you know, they know about all the players in Europe. And again, it's mostly a European-based team. But they often have these friendlies of looking at the younger players. And sometimes they're playing the likes of Guatemala or maybe Honduras or maybe some of the kind of Middle East teams, or, you know, maybe the USA always seems to be a kind of perennial friendly opponent. So there is a little bit of a look to what's coming up. So I think that Lorenzo was very aware of the talent that was coming up at the time. You know, we don't just see the same squad being picked friendly after friendly. So I think that knowledge that he has to start with of some of the core players, and I think one of the key things he has done is found a way to get the best out of those players that were drifting. You know, James Rodriguez is not the player of you know, of 2014. No, he's not the same player as 2018. You know, he's had a struggle at Everton, Olympiacos. You know, he's barely been playing at Sao Paulo recently. You know, he hasn't got that kind of dynamism that probably he did have. But then he's got to have a new style, and you've got to try and find a way of using that talent that he does have. And I think that what Lorenzo always knew is that, you know, Rodriguez does care a great deal about Colombia. You know, he does care about his country. He's probably played better for his country more often than arguably anyone else in his career, certainly since Porto. I mean, obviously some glimpses at Real Madrid here and there. But then it's the same with really Davinson Sanchez. You know, he's obviously left Spurs, gone elsewhere. Yerry Mina has been on a slight slide from, you know, being a Barcelona player at one brief stage and looking like, you know, the best defender in the continent at one point. You know, now he's at Cagliari. So again, his career's been going down. So I think that's been one key issue. I think the other thing that he does is also pick players that will conform to a style and a structure. You know, he looks clearly at desired characteristics, and he's not overswayed by, you know, reputations or names or you know, or the players that might have the ego. I think that's really important. So, you know, if you look at the two kind of the two main midfielders of you know, the three that Colombian play with, you know, I don't think anyone in Europe really, unless you're an absolute, you know, nerd about South American football, would have known much about Richard Rios. And certainly Colombians wouldn't have either. You know, Richard Rios, who's plays for Palmeiras, has never played football in Colombia. So he's basically unknown to Colombia. He'd played futsal. But this was a guy who was effectively picked because of the certain characteristics that Lorenzo thought he had that would be useful. And actually, he was really a kind of bit part player for Palmeiras when he's first selected. He's now, you know, he's probably going to be the breakout star of this tournament. I can see him, you know, going to a, you know, a big European club, you know, in the next few months. I would not be surprised. And the same with John Arias, who a few people know a little bit more about because he was playing for Fluminense in the Copa Libertadores finally, played against Man City and had a very good game in that 4-0 win for Man City over Fluminense. But you're picking guys that weren't necessarily the names. Again, you look at someone like Daniel Munoz, who's been absolutely critical. I mean, you know, cretinously got sent off by elbowing one of the Uruguayans yesterday. But Munoz has been key at right back to prevent some of the better teams that Colombia played against from actually playing their football. You know, John Cordoba, the centre forward who started quite most of those games, is playing at Krasnodar in Russia. And again, has a very good record in there. He had a very good record at Cologne as well. But he's not potentially the name that many Colombians would imagine as being the pinpoint of the Colombian team. You know, you've only got one elite player in Luis Diaz. But what you do have is a combination of all those little things that you really need. You know, you've got speed, you've got creativity, you've got La Pausa, you've got work causes, you've got people who can pass and put their foot in. You've got height. You've got people who've got very good engines. You know, Jefferson Lerma, you know, again, you know, two Crystal Palace players in a Colombia team, you know, and they're two of the most influential ones. But you have this kind of sum of their parts, and it's not ego-based. So I think that's really key. There's a very clear collective focus. I think what's very interesting is what some of the players say about him is that, and what he says as well, is that he puts players in situations where they can perform, they can be comfortable, and where they can succeed. You know, and I think that's really important. He's not playing players out of position. He's not saying, oh, right, you're a name. I have to play you. We'll have to tinker around. So you have to play there, but it doesn't quite work. You know, he's playing players when they can succeed. Like Miguel Borja, who is a centre forward who, you know, is a very slightly hot and cold player. He plays for River Plate. One of those players that, you know, has runs of form, then runs not of form. You know, he put him on at the end, towards the end of the Panama game. So he could succeed, you know, and so he can grow in confidence, scores the penalty. Everyone in the team is delighted because they know how much he cares. It's those kind of things. And I think that he is very aware of helping the players succeed and not asking for them too much. And you kind of get the feeling that Reinaldo Rueda, potentially maybe Kroos, didn't have that knowledge, didn't have that maybe slightly more paternal player-based knowledge type of coaching. That seems to be a very key element of Lorenzo's ethos and ethic and focus. So, but I think what you've got there for is someone that knows how to put a team together, knows how to get rid of egos, knows how to find the best of people and different players, isn't just going to keep the same team if he doesn't have to. You know, Rafael Santos Borré has played a couple of games. You know, you've got you know, Carrascal's played. You've got the kind of the magician of Quintero as another bit of potential genius, or, you know, if you ever need it. So, you know, I think you've got a really interesting blend that's been put together very craftily. And I think what you'll probably also see is that players like Richard Rios, like John Arias, probably like Lukumi, who I think's at Bologna, maybe Cuesta, who I think's at Genk. I wouldn't be surprised if you see some of those players starting to move to bigger clubs, because, you know, it's, you know what it's like, Copa America is a shop window, you know, and there are lots of clubs that have got, you know, wallets ready.
Yeah, I asked you the million-dollar question, Pete, and I think you came up with $999,999 answer there. But if you had the other daughter who had, I think you'd be coaching the team as well, buddy. But yeah, that's what's fascinating. This is that, and interesting you say about Crystal Palace players. Obviously, there's Crystal Palace players doing well in the England squad as well. So, you know, well, up to the Palace guys. Okay, so, I mean, touch on your real sort of home subject here. So how is it playing out back in Colombia? I mean, I know you're not there, but you know, you're up on the zeitgeist in the country. So how's it playing out there? I know you mentioned in the past, I think it's in your book, that football is the only thing that unites us, isn't it?
Yeah, no, this is really what I do academically. So, I mean, I've spent this morning kind of combing through Twitter, X, just looking at the kind of narratives and meanings that are brought out. Because I think you've got to always look at football as being this zero institution, as it's often called. You know, we kind of imagine football as a potential source of power. It's got so much political power, social power, economic power. And it just has to be deployed by anyone that has a message to sell or to use. So this is what we're seeing going on at the moment. You know, I mean, the whole country, first of all, is delighted. You know, this is only, I think, the third Copa America final in the country's history, in terms of the men's anyway. You know, we go back to 1975, obviously 2001, and now this year. So there's a great deal of excitement, and therefore there's a lot of potential manipulation or deployment of this potential power. So I think one of the things that, you know, we saw yesterday was pretty much most of the ministers of the Gustavo Petro government. And for those people who don't know, Petro is a left-leaning or quite substantially left-leaning former guerrilla of the M19 who's been president for the last couple of years. He has a kind of a political process which is called the Paz Total, Total Peace, where he's trying to have lots of different negotiations with the different guerrilla organizations that still exist, different paramilitary organizations, different criminal groups. So this is the kind of the social context. There are still the kind of divisions that Colombia has had. Petro himself has been wearing the national shirt while doing various events, unsurprisingly. So have all his ministers. We saw for example, the Minister of Sport, the Minister of Science, all kind of tweeting things wearing the Colombian shirt. It's the messages that are interesting. Petro is slightly more of an improviser. You know, he doesn't really have a consistent message where he deploys sport necessarily for the nation, nowhere near as much as President Santos did, who was the president in 2014, 2018. That's the main subject of my book. But what you can see in certainly the Minister of Sport and the Minister of Science and also the Foreign Affairs Office is the same words coming out about peace, unity, the whole country. Every Colombian is supporting you. We're all happy. We're all proud. We see these kind of values of bravery, of dedication, of happiness that are very much part of a Colombian general idea to try and change the way the country is perceived. You know, we all know what Colombia is infamous for, but there is always, therefore, a kind of an attempt to show that there is something different about the country, that it's the country of beauty. And in fact, that's something that Petro did say, this is the country of beauty. So that's obviously a very similar narrative in lots of ways to the kind of things that the Santos government was saying. I mean, I'm interested in hashtags. Again, this is a kind of an academic thing, but what's interesting is that the hashtag for this tournament is Orgullo Nacional, national pride. So we're not talking about peace, which is often quite a contentious subject when you're considering guerrilla organizations that lots of Colombians are kind of see as public enemy number one. It's a kind of much more of a free term, an unloaded term. We're just being proud about being Colombian, which might be an easier way to unite than let's just unite with peace in mind. So I think, and that's been a hashtag that everyone is using, whether it's government institutions, but also some of the press as well. And it's part of also ongoing campaigns of the government. So that's kind of, it's nice to see how football's part of that. Again, the press are, as you can imagine, as kind of narrators of national successes and the way that, you know, the country should receive this. One of the things that most interested me was the way they talked about Colombia, the kind of warlike, I mean, it was as fighters, the guerreros, the warriors. But then they talked about Consul Football Alegre, you know, with its happy football. So there's a kind of like this duality of the two polar oppositions of Colombia as being this warrior nation of violence, but also happy football. So I found that very interesting. It was very much seen as a battle. So we have a lot of these heroic narratives, but seeing Uruguay as this, you know, violent, physical, you know, dirty, you know, that kind of narrative is also their enemy. And again, I think one of the other interesting aspects of who's been talking why is is the peace aspect is there. You know, I've seen a couple of peace organisations also saying that, you know, football is for peace. You know, let's remember this, and the whole country is celebrating together. And one more kind of little point is that one of the national indigenous organisations, a part of the country that's often been maligned, often being seen as lesser in old imagery of the nation, somehow backward. You know, they have got their hero in Luis Diaz, you know, the great hero of Colombian football, is an indigenous Colombian of the YU kind of community of La Guajira. So he's also a point of celebration. So, you know, you have all these lovely imaginaries going on and these kind of interesting messages. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens, you know, win or lose on Monday morning, see what kind of narratives are present. But what will certainly be happening is that, you know, probably a lot of these enjoyments of football will be to the tune of the Colombian Copa America official song, which has been done by a guy called Ryan Castro, which also features Luis Diaz and Juanfer Quintero doing some rapping. So we have this line of "Mami, prende la radio, enciende la tele," kind of "Mum, put the radio on, turn on the telly," which feels like it's becoming the song of, you know, the Colombian summer, if you like. It feels like that's going to be an anthem, you know, that's kind of resonating around the country, around, you know, these kind of tiny bars and tiny kind of salsa venues and around TV sets all around the country. So that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing certainly a lot of political messages, a lot of social messages, a lot of manipulation in different ways, maybe sometimes a bit more improvised, but certainly there is kind of defined process of trying to see this kind of hope for the country as well. And, you know, and a victory would only kind of dynamize that even further.
The Colombian equivalent of it's coming home.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. So that's the sort of present. And obviously, Tom's rested on a bit before we disappear. I want us to look at the future. Firstly, the final on Monday. Stevie, can they beat Argentina? And will they beat Argentina?
They can. Can and will. That's the thing. It's welding can to will. Anything in football can happen. It's making it will. You know, turn it into will happen. Argentina on the crest of an incredible wave, but so were Colombia. Again, it might come down to that hierarchy. You know, they've gone toe-to-toe with Brazil in the group stages. They'll have gleaned a lot of confidence from that. They've you know, defeated Uruguay in the semi-finals. Which version of Colombia will tip up? Will they be flowing and going for it like they have done at times during this competition? Or will they be that little bit more circumspect? You know, having been circumspect against Uruguay, Argentina might position themselves, you know, not to fall for the same punchline. So they're going to have to come at it with a slightly different approach. But there's no reason why they can't catch Argentina off balance. I'm going to be bullish and say yes. Why not? Colombia need to win this, and they're going to do.
You need to shake it up a bit. It'd be great for.
It would be. It's great that Argentina have risen again. It's great that they won the World Cup. You know, the World Cup desperately needed a South American winner after so long.
Agreed.
You know, and that's nothing against Argentina whatsoever, but in the name of variation and as many teams doing well as possible, it would be great for Colombia to win.
Pete, same question to you with a little added sort of one as well. And if they did win, what would that mean? What would that mean for Colombian football?
So can they win? I think they have to win it in normal time. I fear that the witchcraft and incredibly annoying presence of Dibu Martinez, of Emilio Martinez in goal, is almost a defining power in the penalty shootout. So I fear for any team that has to beat Argentina on penalties, just because they've done it. You know, they've won some big ones, and Martinez has got something like a 50%, you know, stoppage ratio of in the penalty shootouts. I think the referee will play a key part. I think one of the main, I think Uruguay last night, and certainly what Uruguay did against Brazil as well, was play very physical football. I think that almost quite un-Bielsa-like, actually. I think I felt quite disappointed in how, I'm not surprised either in how they played against Brazil. There's a lot of rivalry and a lot of history in that game. But I think that Uruguay are more than that. And I think one of the problems in this particular Copa America has been that type of refereeing, of allowing a little bit too much, you know, and that often has led to the cynical fouls. Then things tend to degenerate. If that's the kind of game it is, then I think it could really go either way. It really could, because I think that it will just take a corner. It will take a bit of magic. It will take a bit of dynamism. They tend not to be the games where the really flow players most shine. It often tends to be slightly more dynamic players who can make that real rush. And Colombia have got a few of those. You know, Argentina are heavy favourites. You know, I think there's obviously the narratives of Messi, you know, to consider. Is this his last major tournament? Should he go out for a win? You know, will he go out on a win? It's obviously in the US as well. I wonder what impact the crowd violence at the end of the Uruguay-Colombia game will have, where we see Darwin Nunez having a fight, or various other Uruguayan players, you know, fighting, stroke, protecting their families from Colombian fans. You know, takes two to tango, but, you know, I wonder what extent narratives will turn slightly against the Colombian fans, who have generally been, in most tournaments, one of the prime joys of international tournaments, not just the men's tournaments as well. I think, you know, certainly we look back to the 2023 Women's World Cup, you know, the Colombian fans were fantastic in that and provide the carnival and provide the colour, you know, and there's a very large diaspora in the US as well. So I feel that Colombia have to win it in normal time. That's why I kind of think, but I think they can do it. I don't think Argentina are playing at their best, but they've equally got, you know, very, very good, dangerous forwards who can score that goal, you know, in 1 second. What will it mean to the country? It will mean a colossal amount. Will it be transformational in terms of, you know, wider society? No. The message that infer it can, will they be there? Yes. You know, we will see probably the president inviting them to the presidential palace, whatever happens, and we'll see a speech that no doubt will associate them with national values and unity and teamwork and probably the peace process as well. We will see an explosion of joy if they win, like probably Colombia hasn't seen probably since, oh God, I don't want to say 1993, because about 80 people died in Bogota alone after that win against Argentina. But hopefully they will celebrate with a little bit more sense, if you like. But I think it will be a major landmark historic moment. You know, it's a kind of another argument for hierarchy. It will be a huge confidence boost in lots of ways. It will be a moment that, again, relegates the traditional, typical narratives of drugs, violence to the sidelines, and that's always a good thing. No doubt the Sun, when they see it, will come up with some cocaine-related pun that will ruin everything from that kind of gutter press that we don't expect anything less of. You know, I think it could potentially be, you know, it's that kind of feel-good factor that Colombia always needs. How much that is exploited by a president who's not particularly good at doing sporting nationalism projects, I don't know. But there certainly are other organisations that will know how to exploit it. And we can look at, you know, the Football for Peace projects around the country that, you know, we'll see potentially renewed interest in those kind of things going on. I think it's worth also mentioning the women's football, you know, here, you know, in terms of what also happens there. You know, we have the last 2 years in 2022 when, you know, Colombia aren't in the Qatar World Cup final. You know, their under-17 team are World Cup runners-up. You know, that's the Linda Caicedo generation. The under-20 team got to the quarterfinals of their version of the World Cup. The women's full team, you know, in 2022 were the runners-up in the Copa America hosted in Colombia. Last year, you know, 2023, Colombia are in the quarterfinals. They lose to England, you know, but beat Germany, have a great tournament. Linda Caicedo becomes a star. I hope that women's football is not obscured, but the women's team are in the Olympics coming up. So we have this perfect switch transfer from Colombia doing really well in the Copa America to hopefully the women's team hopefully doing really, really well in the Olympics, which will give a chance to this dual narrative of both men and women representing Colombia, providing examples of what the country is. And I really hope that happens. You know, I think that will be a major moment. I think one of the most important things as well is that, you know, we have two very interesting heroes. You know, we have Linda Caicedo, who is an Afro-Colombian, being the star and pinup girl of the women's team at Real Madrid. And we have Luis Diaz, a kind of Wayuu indigenous person, you know, as the star of the men's team. And they are traditionally two figures that are on the margins of Colombian imaginaries. So that itself, you know, is a really interesting image, a really interesting symbol, and a really interesting situation for Colombian football as a whole to be in 2024.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You mentioned about the gutter press. I French Gerrard be a headlock, which it wasn't the sun, but it was some akin to that, where it said success for Colombia with like a shot in the arm. And you're just thinking, you know, what are you doing? I mean, you know, there's that certain hidden metaphor, isn't there, of the drugs. And anyway, that's, you know.
It was like that go Kane headline in 2018 as well. It was like pathetic.
They want to slap. Anyway, if anybody wants to watch the game, as the guys have mentioned, John, very early on Monday morning, so stay up, watch England beat Spain, hopefully, he said, fingers crossed. Hoping no Spanish friends of mine are listening. And then, you know, switch over and watch Colombia, hopefully, beat Argentina, and create a little bit of history. So that was our conversation about the upsurging Colombian fortunes and their new coach. So thanks, Pete, for your magnificent knowledge and expertise again, buddy. Really enjoyed it. Politics and football, you can't whack it, can you?
It's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for the space. It's always good to talk about these things. I just hope it's a good game. I feel, you know, world football, particularly given what Bielsa said about the way football's going, and I think what we've discussed a lot, you know, world football needs two good finals with good football being played. So let's hope that, you know, England and Spain and Colombia and Argentina, you know, can put two games on and, you know, hopefully, you know, the right teams win.
Hey, yes, sir. Stevie, enjoyed it, mate?
Oh, fantastic. As always. Yeah, an absolute joy.
Grand. Okay, guys, so thanks for that. And thanks for listening in, guys. So I hope you've enjoyed it. And catch us again next time on the Lob Podcast from These Football Times. But for now, bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.